He heard voices then as he lay with his face against the dusty earth. And he lifted his head and saw the women from the orchard running towards him across the open field. The voices were shrill but faint, and the words were in Hebrew. He knew that he was home. Steadying himself against the shattered body of the mirage, he came to his feet with the broken arm dangling at his side, and he tried to shout to them, "Go back! Beware!" But his voice was a throaty croak, and they ran on towards him. Their dresses and aprons were gay spots of colour against the dry brown earth. He pushed himself away from the aircraft and staggered to meet the running women. "Go back!" he croaked in his own terrible distress, with the grip of his G-suit strangling his movements and the evaporating fuel cold as ice in his hair and down his face. Within the battered howl of the mirage, a puddle of Avtur had been heated by the white-hot shell of the jet compressor. Its low volatility at last was raised to flashpoint, and a dying spark from the electronic equipment was enough to ignite it. With a dull but awful roar, the mirage bloomed with dark crimson flame and sooty black smoke. The wind ripped the flames outwards in great streamers and pennants that engulfed all around them, and David staggered onwards in the midst of the roaring furnace that seemed to consume the very air. He held his breath. If he had not, the flame would have scorched his lungs. He closed his eyes tightly against the agony and ran on blindly. His body and his limbs were protected by the fireproof pressure suit and boots and gloves, but his head was bare and soaked with jet fuel. As he ran, his head burned like a torch. His hair frizzled off in a stinking puff of flame, and the skin of his scalp and neck and face was exposed. The flames burnt his ears off and most of his nose. They flayed off his skin in a blistering sheet, and then they ate into the raw flesh. They burnt away his lips and exposed his teeth and part of the bone of his jaw. They ate through his eyelids and stripped the living meat from his cheeks. David ran on through the burning air and smoke, and he did not believe that such pain was possible. It exceeded all his imaginings and swamped all the senses of his body and mind, but he knew he must not scream. The pain was a blackness, and the vivid colours of flame in his tightly closed eyes. It was a roaring in his ears like all the winds of the world, and in his flesh it was the goads and whips and burning hooks of hell itself. But he knew he could not let this terrible fire enter his body, and he ran on without screaming. The women from the orchard were brought up short by the sudden forest of flame and black smoke that rose up in front of them, engulfing the squashed insect body of the aircraft and closing around the running figure of the pilot. It was a solid, impenetrable wall of heat and smoke that blotted out all ahead of them and forced them to draw back, awed and horrified, before its raging hot breath. They stood in a small group, panting and wild-eyed. Then, abruptly, a freak gust of wind opened the heavy, oily curtains of smoke, and out of them stumbled a dreadful thing with a scorched and smoking body and a head of flame. Blindly it came out of the smoke, one arm hanging, and its feet dragging and staggering in the soft earth. They stared at this thing in horror, frozen in silence, and it came towards them. Then a strapping girl, with a strong brown body and a mane of dark hair, uttered a cry of compassion and raced to meet him. As she ran, she stripped off her heavy, voluminous skirt of thick wool, leaving her strong brown legs bare. She reached David, and she swirled the skirt over his head, smothering the flames that still ate into his flesh. The other women followed her, using their clothing to wrap him as he fell and rolled on the earth. Only then did David begin to scream, from that lipless mouth with the exposed teeth. It was a sound that none of them would ever forget. As he screamed, the eyes were open, with the lashes and brow and most of the lids burned away. The eyes were dark indigo blue in the glistening mask of wet, scorched meat, and the little blood vessels, sealed by the heat, popped open and dribbled and spurted. As he screamed, the blood and lymph bubbled from the nostril holes where his nose had been, and his body writhed and heaved and convulsed as spasm after spasm of unbearable agony hit him. The women had to hold him down to control his struggles and to prevent him tearing with clawed fingers at the ruins of his face. He was still screaming when the doctor from the kibbutz slashed open the sleeve of his pressure suit with a scalpel and pressed the morphine needle into the twitching, jumping muscles of his arm. The brig saw the last bright radar image fade from the plot and heard the young radar officer report formally, "No further contact." And a great silence fell on the command bunker. And they were all watching him. He stood hunched over the plot, and his big bony fists were clasped at his sides. His face was stiff and expressionless, but his eyes were terrible. It seemed that the frantic voices of his two pilots still echoed from the speakers above his head, as they called to each other in the extremes of mortal conflict. They had all heard David's voice, hoarse with sorrow and fear. "Joe! No, Joe! Oh, God, no!" And they knew what that meant. They had lost them both, and the brig was still stunned by the sudden, incalculable turn that the sortie had taken. At the moment he had lost control of his fighters, he had known that disaster was unavoidable, and now his son was dead. He wanted to cry out aloud, to protest against the futility of it. He closed his eyes tightly for a few seconds, and when he opened them, he was in control again. "General alert," he snapped. "All squadrons to red standby." He knew they faced an international crisis. "I want air cover over the area they went down. They may have ejected. Put up two phantom flights and keep an umbrella over them. I want helicopters sent in immediately with paratrooper guards and medical teams." Command bunker moved swiftly into general alert procedure. "Get me the Prime Minister," he said. He was going to have to do a lot of explaining, and he spared a few vital seconds to damn David Morgan roundly and bitterly. The Air Force doctor took one look at David's charred and scorched head, and he swore softly. "We'll be lucky to save this one." Loosely, he swathed the head in Vaseline bandages, and they hurried with David's blanket-wrapped body on the stretcher to the Bell 205 helicopter waiting in the orchard. The Bell touched down on the helipad at Hadassah Hospital, and a medical team was ready for him. 1 hour and 53 minutes after the Mirage hit the irrigation canal, David had passed through the sterile lock into the special burns unit on the third floor of the hospital, into a quiet and secluded little world where everybody wore masks and long green sterile robes, and the only contact with the outside world was through the double-glazed windows, and even the air he breathed was scrubbed and cleaned and filtered. However, David was enfolded in the soft, dark clouds of morphine, and he did not hear the quiet voices of the masked figures as they worked over him. "It's third degree over the entire area. No attempt to clean it or touch it, sister. Not until it stabilizes. I'm going to spray with Epiguard, and we'll go to intramuscular tetracycline 4 hourly against infection. It'll be 2 weeks before we dare touch it." "Very well, Doctor." "And sister, 15 milligrams of morphine 6 hourly. We're going to have a lot of pain with this one." Pain was infinity, an endless ocean across which the wave patterns marched relentlessly to burst up the beaches of his soul. There were times when the surf of pain ran high, and each burst of it threatened to shatter his reason. Again, there were times when it was low, almost gentle in its throbbing rhythm, and he drifted far out upon the ocean of pain to where the morphine mists enfolded him. Then the mists parted, and a brazen sun beat down upon his head, and he squirmed and writhed and cried out. His skull seemed to bloat and swell until it must burst, and the open nerve ends screamed for surcease. Then suddenly there was the sharply beloved sting of the needle in his flesh, and the mists closed about him once more. "I don't like the look of this at all. Have we taken a culture, sister?" "Yes, Doctor." "What are we growing?" "I'm afraid it's strep." "Yes, I thought so. I think we'll change to cloxacillin. See if we can get a better response with that." With the pain, David became aware of a smell. It was the smell of carrion and things long dead, the smell of vermin in dirty blankets, of vomit and excreta, and the odour of wet garbage festering in dark alleys. And at last he came to know that the smell was the rotting of his own flesh, as the bacteria of streptococcus infection attacked the exposed tissue. They fought it with the drugs. But now the pain was underlined with the fevers of infection and the terrible burning thirsts which no amount of liquids could slake. With the fever came the nightmares and the fantasies to plague and goad him even further beyond the limits of his endurance. "Joe!" he cried out in his agony. "Try for the sun, Joe! Break left now! Go! Go!" And then he was sobbing from the ruined and broken mouth. "Oh, Joe! Oh, God, no! Joe!" Until the night sister could no longer bear it, and she came hurrying with the syringe, and his screams turned to babbling, and then into the low whimper and moan of the drug sleep. "We'll start with the acroflavin dressings now, sister." When they changed the dressings every 48 hours, it was under general anaesthetic, for the entire head was of raw flesh, a bland, expressionless head, a head like a child's drawing, crude lines and harsh colours, hairless, earless, streaked and mottled with yellow runs and patches of soft pus and corruption. "We're getting a response from the cloxicillin. It's looking a lot healthier, sister." The naked flesh of his eyelids had contracted, pulling back like the glistening petals of a pink rose, exposing the eyeballs to the air without respite. They had filled the eyes' sockets with a yellow ointment to soothe and moisten them, to keep out the loathsome infection that covered his head. The ointment prevented vision. "I think we'll go for an abdominal pedicil now. Will you prep for afternoon theatre, please, sister?" Now it was time for the knife, and David was to learn that the pain and the knife lived together in terrible sin. They lifted a long flap of skin and flesh from his belly, leaving it still attached at one end, and they rolled it into a fat sausage. Then they strapped his good arm, the one without the plaster cast, to his side, and they stitched the free end of the sausage to his forearm, training it to draw its blood supply from there. Then they brought him back from theatre and left him trussed and helpless and blind with the pedestal fastened to his arm, like a remora to the belly of a shark. "Well, we've saved both eyes." The voice was proud, fond almost, and David looked up and saw them for the first time. They were gathered around his cot, a circle of craning heads, mouths and noses covered by surgical masks. But his vision was still smeary with ointment and distorted by the drip irrigation that had replaced it. "Now we'll go for the eyelids." It was the knife again. The contracted and bunched up eyelids split and reshaped and stitched. The knife and pain, and the familiar sickly taste and stink of anaesthetic that saturated his body and seemed to exude from the very pores of his skin. "Beautiful, really lovely. We've cleaned up the infection nicely. Now we can begin." The head was cleansed of its running rivers of pus, and now it was glistening and wet, bald and bright red, the colour of a cocktail cherry, as granulation tissue formed. There were two gnarled and twisted flaps for ears, the double row of teeth startlingly white and perfect where the lips had been eaten away. A long white blade of exposed bone outlined the point of the jaw. The nose was a stump with the nostrils like the double muzzles of a shotgun, and only the eyes were still beautiful. Dark indigo, and flawlessly white between lids of shocking crimson and neatly laid black stitches. "We'll begin at the back of the neck. Will you prep for this afternoon's theatre, please, sister?" It was a variation on the theme of the knife. They planed sheets of live skin from his thighs and meshed them to allow a wider spread. Then they laid them over the exposed flesh, covering a little at each session and evaluating each attempt, while David lay in his cot and rode the long swells of pain. "That one's no good. I'm afraid we'll have to scrap it and try again." While his thighs grew a new crop of skin, they planed fresh sheets from his calves, so that each donor site became a new source of pain. "Lovely. An edge-to-edge take with that graft." Slowly the cap of skin extended up across the nape of his neck and over his scalp. The meshing of the skin grafts gave them a patterned effect, regular as the scales of a fish, and the new grafts were hard-looking and raised. "We can move the pedestal up now. This afternoon's theatre, doctor?"
"Yes, please, sister."
David came to know that they operated every Thursday in the Burns unit. He came to dread the Thursday morning rounds, when the consultant and his staff crowded around his cot and touched and prodded and discussed the restructuring of his flesh with an impersonal candour that chilled him. They freed the fat sausage of flesh from his belly, and it dangled from his arm like some grotesque white leech, seeming to have a life of its own, drawing blood and sustenance from its grip upon his forearm. They lifted his arm and strapped it across his chest, and the raw end of the pedestal they split and stitched to his jaw and to the stump of his nose. "It's taken very nicely. We'll begin shaping it this afternoon. We'll have him at the head of the theatre list. Will you see to that, please, sister?" With the living flesh that they had stolen from his belly, they fashioned a crude lump of a nose, taut, narrow lips, and a new covering for his jawbone. "The oedema has settled. This afternoon I'll go for the bone graft on the jaw." They opened his chest and split his fourth rib laterally, robbing it of a long sliver of bone, and they grafted this to the damaged jawbone. Then they spread the flesh of the pedestal over it and stitched it all into place. On Thursdays it was the knife and the stink of anaesthetic, and for the days in between it was the ache and pain of abused and healing flesh. They fined down the new nose, piercing it with nostrils. They finished the reconstruction of his eyelids. They laid the last grafts behind his ears. They cut a double zigzag incision around the base of his jaw, where the contracting scar tissue was trying to draw his chin down onto his chest. The new lips took firm hold on the existing muscles, and David gained control of them, so he could form his words again and speak clearly. The last area of raw flesh was closed beneath the patchwork of skin grafts, flesh grafts, and stitches. David was no longer a high infection risk, and he was moved from a sterile environment. Once again he saw human faces, not merely eyes, peering over white surgical masks. The faces were friendly, cheerful faces, men and women proud of their achievement in saving him from death and refleshing his ravaged head. "You'll be allowed visitors now, and I expect you'll welcome that," said the consultant. He was a distinguished-looking young surgeon who had left a highly paid post at a Swiss clinic to head this burns and plastic surgery unit. "I don't think I'll be having any visitors." David had lost contact with the reality of the outside world during the 9 months in the burns unit. "Oh, yes, you will," the surgeon told him. "We've had regular inquiries on your progress from a number of people. Isn't that correct, sister?" "That's right, doctor. You can let them know that he's allowed visitors now." The consultant and his group began to move on. "Doctor," David called him back, "I want to look at a mirror." And they were all silent, immediately embarrassed. This request of his had been denied many times over the last months. "Damn it," David became angry. "You can't protect me from it forever." The consultant gestured for the others to leave, and they filed out of the ward while he came back to David's bed. "All right, David," he agreed gently. "We'll find you a mirror, though we don't have much use for them around here." For the first time in the many months he had known him, David glimpsed the depths of his compassion, and he wondered at it, that a man who lived constantly amongst great pain and terrible disfigurement could still be moved by it. "You must understand that how you are now is not how you will always be. All I have been able to do so far is heal your exposed flesh and make you functional again. You are once more a viable human being. You have not experienced the loss of any of your faculties, but I will not pretend that you are beautiful. However, there remains much that I can still do to change that. Your ears, for example, can be reconstructed with the material I have reserved for that purpose." He indicated the stump of the pedestal that still hung from David's forearm. "There is much fine work still to be done about the nose and mouth and eyes." He paced slowly the length of the ward and looked out into the sunlight for a moment before turning back again and coming forward to face David. "But let me be truthful with you. There are limitations to what I can do. The muscles of expression, those delicate little muscles around the eyes and mouth, have been destroyed. I cannot replace those. The hair follicles of your lashes and brows and scalp have been burned away. You'll be able to wear a wig, but..." David turned to his bedside locker and took from the drawer his wallet. He opened it and drew out a photograph. It was the one which Hannah had taken so long ago, of Deborah and David sitting at the rock pool in the oasis of Ain Gedi and smiling at each other. He handed it to the surgeon. "Is that what you looked like, David? I never knew." The regret showed like a quick shadow in his eyes. Can you make me look like that again? The surgeon studied the photograph a moment longer. The young god's face with the dark mop of hair and the clean, pure lines of the profile. No, he said. I could not even come close. It's all I wanted to know. David took the photograph back from him. You say I'm functional now. Let's leave it at that, shall we? You don't want further cosmetic surgery? We can still do a lot. Doctor, I've lived under the knife for 9 months. I've had the taste of antibiotics and anesthetic in my mouth, and the stink of it in my nostrils for all that time. Now all I want is a little escape from pain, a little peace, and the taste of clean air. Very well, the surgeon agreed readily. It is not important that we do it now. You could come back at any time in the future. He walked to the door of the ward. Come on, let's go find a mirror. There was one in the nurse's room, beyond the double doors at the end of the passage. The room itself was empty, and the mirror was set into the wall above the wash basin. The surgeon stood in the doorway and leaned against the jamb. He lit a cigarette and watched as David crossed towards the mirror and then halted abruptly as he saw his own image. He wore the blue hospital dressing gown over his pajamas. He was tall and finely proportioned. His shoulders were wide, his hips narrow, and he had the same lithe and beautiful man's body. However, the head that topped it was something from a nightmare. Involuntarily, he gasped out aloud, and the gash of a mouth parted in sympathy. It was a tight, lipless mouth like that of a cobra, white-rimmed and harsh. Drawn by the awful fascination of horror, David drew closer to the mirror. The thick mane of his dark hair had concealed the peculiar elongation of his skull. He had never realized that it jutted out behind like that. For now the hair was gone, and the bald curve was covered with meshed skin, thickened and raised. The skin and flesh of his face was a patchwork, joined by seams of scar tissue drawn tightly over his cheekbones, giving him a vaguely Asiatic appearance. But the eyes were round and startled, with clumsy lids and puffed, dead-looking flesh beneath. His nose was a shapeless blob, out of balance with the other coarsened features, and his ears were gnarled excrescences, seemingly fastened haphazardly to the sides of his head. The whole of it was bland and bald and boiled-looking. The gash of a mouth twisted briefly in a horrid rictus, and then regained its frozen shape. "I can't smile," said David. "No," agreed the surgeon. "You will have no control of your expressions." That was the truly horrifying aspect of it. It was not the twisted and tortured flesh, with the scarring and stitch marks still so evident. It was the expressionlessness of this mask. The frozen features seemed long dead, incapable of human warmth or feeling. "Yeah, but you should have seen the other guy," David said softly, and the surgeon chuckled without mirth. "We'll have those last few stitches behind your ears out tomorrow. I shall remove what remains of the pedestal from your arm, and then you can be discharged. Come back to us when you're ready." David ran his hand gingerly over the bald, patterned skull. "I'm going to save a fortune in haircuts and razor blades," he said, and the surgeon turned quickly away and walked down the passage, leaving David to get to know his new head. The clothes that they had found for him were cheap and ill-fitting, slacks and open-neck shirt, a light jacket and sandals, and he asked for some head covering, anything to conceal the weird new shape of his scalp. One of the nurses found him a cloth cap, and then told him that a visitor was waiting for him in the hospital superintendent's department. He was a major from the military provost marshal's office, a lean grey-haired man with cold grey eyes and a tight, hard mouth. He introduced himself without offering to shake hands, and then opened the file on the desk in front of him. "I have been instructed by my office to ask for the formal resignation of your commission in the Israeli Air Force," he started. And David stared at him. In the long, pain-filled, fever-hot nights, the thought of flying once more had seemed like a prospect of paradise. "I don't understand," he mumbled, and reached for a cigarette, breaking the first match and then puffing quickly as the second flared. "You want my resignation? And if I refuse?" Then we shall have no alternative other than to convene a court-martial and to try you for dereliction of duty and refusing, in the face of the enemy, to obey the lawful orders of your superior officer. I see, David nodded heavily and drew on the cigarette. The smoke stung his eyes. Doesn't seem I have any choice. I have prepared the necessary documents. Please sign here and here, and I shall sign as witness. David bowed over the papers and signed. The pen scratched loudly in the silent room. Thank you. The major gathered his papers and placed them in his briefcase. He nodded at David and started for the door. So now I am an outcast, said David softly. And the man stopped. They stared at each other for a moment, and then the major's expression altered slightly, and the cold grey eyes became ferocious. You are responsible for the destruction of two warplanes that are irreplaceable and whose loss has caused us incalculable harm. You are responsible for the death of a brother officer and for bringing our country to the very brink of open war, which would have cost many thousands more of our young people's lives and possibly our very existence. You have embarrassed our international friends and given strength to our enemies. He paused and drew a deep breath. The recommendation of my office was that you be brought to trial and that the prosecution be instructed to ask for the death penalty. It was only the personal intervention of the Prime Minister and of Major General Mordecai that saved you from that. In my view, instead of bemoaning your fate, you should consider yourself highly fortunate. He turned away, and his footsteps cracked on the stone floor as he strode from the room. In the bleak, impersonal lobby of the hospital, David was suddenly struck by a reluctance to walk out into the spring sunshine through the glass swing doors. He had heard that long-term prisoners felt this way when the time came for their release. Before he reached the doors, he turned aside and went down to the hospital synagogue. In a corner of the quiet, square hall, he sat for a long time. The stained-glass windows, set high in the nave, filled the air with shafts of coloured light when the sun came through, and a little of the peace and beauty of that place stayed with him and gave him courage when at last he walked out into the square and boarded a bus for Jerusalem. He found a seat at the rear and beside a window. The bus pulled away and ground slowly up the hill towards the city. He became aware that he was being watched, and he lifted his head to find that a woman with two young children had taken a seat in front of him. She was a poorly dressed, harassed-looking woman, prematurely aged, and she held the grubby younger infant on her lap and fed it from a plastic bottle. However, the second child was an angelic little girl of 4 or 5 years. She had huge dark eyes and a head of thick curls. She stood on the seat facing backwards with one thumb thrust deeply into her mouth. She was watching David steadily over the back of the seat, studying his face with that total absorption and candor of the child. David felt a sudden warmth of emotion for the child, a longing for the comfort of human contact, of which he had been deprived all these months. He leaned forward in his seat, trying to smile, reaching out a gentle hand to touch the child's arm. She removed her thumb from her mouth and shrank away from him, turning to her mother and clinging to her arm, hiding her face in the woman's blouse. At the next stop, David stepped down from the bus and left the road to climb the stony hillside.